Welcome to this week's episode of From the Lighthouse. Today, I am joined by Sam Twyford Moore, a writer and cultural critic. His first book, The Rapids, Ways of Looking at Mania, was published by New South Publishing and the University of Toronto Press in North America. He was formerly festival director and CEO of the Emerging Writers Festival. As a writer, he has contributed to a wide range of publications, including The Monthly, Senses of Cinema, the Los Angeles Review of Books, the Sydney Morning Herald, and many others. Today, we will be talking about his latest book, Castmates. Sam, I'd love if you could start by telling us a little bit about Castmates and where the idea started, the writing of it, and just a general intro into a fantastic book.
Sure. So Castmates is a group biography of four Australian actors, Errol Flynn, Peter Finch, Goblil and Nicole Kidman. It was a book I pitched in 2019 after I had gone down to Carriage Works in Sydney, where Russell Crowe was holding an exhibition as part of an auction that he was running, where he was selling off all of his memorabilia to pay for his divorce. And it was called The Art of Divorce. It was a very cheeky collection. He did a lot of publicity around it, and it sort of started making me think about the lives of actors, because it had lots of material from his early career through to his breakout in Hollywood. And I wrote a piece about that for the magazine Kill Your Darlings, and then went, oh, is this something that could turn into a book where I profile other actors in the same way? And I pitched New South, who I'd worked with previously, and got the book across the line as this group biography, and then went about writing it, and was sort of, you know, like about 6 months in, and obviously COVID hits, but it was really just an ideal book to be working on during those lockdown years, because it was a lot of watching movies, a lot of ordering rare books off eBay, and sort of just being at home, thinking about these four figures and their lives and working it all out.
Look, and I guess that was the other thing that I was really curious about, is the choice, how you came to settle upon those four actors.
Yeah, well, in the Russell Crowe exhibition, there was a costume that Errol Flynn wore in a movie called The Adventures of Don Juan, and it didn't sell, which was sort of interesting to me. And it was sort of the start of the proper start of the book was going back to Errol Flynn as this early Australian Hollywood icon and thinking about why didn't that costume sell? Why was Russell Crowe selling it? And then looking at Errol Flynn's legacy. And then it became, well, if I start with Flynn, who breaks out in Hollywood in 1935 in the movie Captain Blood, and then obviously climbs even greater heights with Robin Hood, how do I get to today? And then it became, who are the figures that could fill in the gaps? And Peter Finch came to me because, you know, there wasn't a lot of film production in the 40s and 50s and 60s in Australia, but he did come back and make a couple of films. Goblil, just this huge, hugely consequential star of the 70s and 80s. And then Nicole sort of being the person who can get me right up until today. It was a bit of like a magic act trying to find out who these people were. But once they sort of came to me, it was living with them for a year or so to try and figure out what their lives were and what they meant to us.
Look, I think that was one of the things that I found really fascinating about reading the book, because I will, you know, full disclaimer, you know, sort of film, Australian film, I you know, I'm not a buff, and so for me there are any number of figures that you could have chosen that I wouldn't have known about as you know, as well. So I guess, you know, in a sense I'm either your ideal reader or you know, not. But what fascinated me was the fact that you did in taking that path, we still had references to, you know, sort of figures, you know, sort of like Heath Ledger or, you know, Mel Gibson and things like, you know, sort of the perhaps the more expected figures, but what we got was this lovely sort of underside, and also this through line that I think was much more interesting and nuanced than would have happened had we have gone through a sort of a more traditional or expected trajectory. But I imagine it was really it was really fascinating piecing all of this together. Was it something that happened organically, or was there some kind of method there that was guiding that sort of that process of weaving together
the four subjects?
Yeah. Because I think that it was there was this lovely sort of elegant thread that ran through and created the connections, but they weren't necessarily expected sort of connections. Mm-hmm. And they were certainly not connections that anyone who hadn't done a significant amount of research would have known about. And so I did sort of wonder whether, sort of at the outset, you knew it was going to be these four figures, and it was a kind of something that you shaped, or whether it was a kind of an organic sort of book that emerged out of the research.
Yeah, I think pretty organic in terms of there were so many unknown knowns and known unknowns going forward in the start. And really, I do think I had the four of them earlier on, but I didn't necessarily know the connections between them. Like, I wasn't aware that Peter Finch and Errol Flynn co-starred in this terrible movie together in the 1950s, and their lives kind of intersected and there were these connections. So it was drawing those out through the research, and then the other part of the research was really my methodology was very much I want to watch every movie they were in. Like, I don't want to be lazy and not go down the rabbit holes of the bad movies and the forgotten movies, because in some ways those are the most interesting. So there's a uniformity to each of the biographies in as much as they are all roughly the same word count, around 20,000 to 25,000 words. So these short biographies connected together, and the other uniformity is that they all had this same approach of starting with the films and then researching the lives and doing those in tandem. So and watching the films pretty much chronologically as well, which was a really lovely experience of really watching someone age across these different films and develop as an artist as well, and fall on hard times, certainly in the case of Peter Finch and Errol Flynn and Gopalil, all to different extents have fallow periods. So yeah, there was a rhythm to it that kind of came to me as I went along, which was unexpected, I suppose.
Because I certainly found, as a reader, it wasn't the book that I expected from the cover, I felt that it was, sort of more likely to be a sort of a glitzy, sort of like star-studded, gossipy kind of thing, which you tend to expect and associate with, sort of anything to do with Hollywood, anything to do with movie stars. And instead we got this much more sort of nuanced and, I found it, sort of really compelling to read, because it was subtle, and it was also just, there was so much of the cultural and the historical and actually the political aspects of shaping, the perception of these actors and Australian, acting and cinema.
I think it's still gossipy a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I know.
No, no.
I'm sorry. I'm the opposite.
I guess I didn't see that.
It was Matthew McConaughey. He was there. Yeah, you went to same school. Yeah. You were basically brothers.
Gossiping isn't necessarily a pejorative in every case, but I really like what you're saying, because that's very kind. And I think what I was trying to do was not think about this necessarily as a film book, but as a cultural history primarily, and also partly a political history, because one of the working models for the book was, there's a trilogy of books by a film critic called Jay Hoberman, who is an extraordinary writer and a very gifted kind of political biographer in a way, but his Dream Life trilogy, which touches on a phrase from Norman Mailer, really looks at the political history of America through movies and provides a kind of in tandem, twinned narrative of the political machinations of America in the 1960s to the 1990s. The Dream Life kind of is mostly about the Cold War period. But then looking at the movies as they individually came out. So I was very inspired by that book, but then wanted to tie in biography, because I think part of the problem with writing about Australian cinema is it does really go dormant for about 30 years. So there's 30 years of production that you really can't talk about in depth, which is just to say, you know, you can kind of become an expert in Australian cinema in the mid-century. And I think I say this in the book, within about a month, you can watch all of the movies that Australia produced in the 1960s in about 16 days. So it was partly to introduce the biographical stuff, and the cultural history stuff was to fill in those gaps a little bit and carry me through.
Well, I think, just as an example, for those who haven't yet read the book, but the Keating, Lerman, Kidman, you know, I don't think that I'd ever connected or know. Well, I certainly didn't know that Keating was into ballroom dancing, for example.
Yeah, I don't think he was into it. He claimed to be a refugee of the ballroom dancing halls because his parents were competitive ballroom dancers. So, I mean, the Lerman stuff, Baz Luhrmann and Keating's relationship was new to me. I didn't have any sense that that Keating had brought on Baz Luhrmann to art direct, essentially, the 1992-93 federal campaign, which is this amazing moment in Australian history that this young, hot young director, film director, comes on to be so instrumental in the image of an election campaign. It's sort of unthinkable, but it feels very American, you know, like it's a kind of Americanization of the political system that we don't get a lot here.
And of course, you were kind of open with that as well with Crow and him sort of getting involved as well. So there is that real sense of that cultural history and the richness, but also I think of the dilemma as well, because it does feel as though you are tapping into that sense that Australia has a difficult time. You know, I think it has a difficult time with its stars. It has a difficult time, you know, sort of with film and producing, you know, sort of identity, which I think is really complicated, and you go into beautifully. Would you like to just talk a little bit about your insights into, you know, sort of the wrestling with, I mean, even just the fact that, as you say, I mean, I guess Russell had Errol's outfit, but, you know, nobody else wanted it.
Well, he didn't want it. It was like a gift to him that he wanted to get rid of. I suppose it is interesting writing into Australian film as a sort of genre. You know, we don't have a lot of books on the subject, and they tend towards the academic. And partly that is there is not a great demand for Australian cinema from Australians themselves, and it's often problematized by this kind of generalized opinion that Australians don't like their own movies, so why would they read a book about them? But I think it's really important to look at our cinema history for the gaps, for the absences, but also what I sort of hit on early on in writing was really the nation-making exercise of Australia. If you think about Federation as 1901, and then you think about Australia really being the producers of the first feature film in the world, the Kelly Gang story in 1907, those two things are kind of in tandem. So it is sort of, we were both making the nation itself and then also making our own film industry, and they were in lockstep for a really long time, including that kind of dip in confidence in the 40s and 50s. And 60s, and Menzies not being interested in restarting the film industry, and then those kind of social democratic impulses of Whitlam coming in the 70s, and the film industry being revived by that literally in a material sense of being funded by Whitlam, but also there was an energy, a new energy, and a kind of new nationalism that came out of that period as well. So that's kind of the kind of thinking that I've taken towards the book, and I think it's important. But I also think there's so many great Australian films at the same time, and I think we should be more proud of kind of the weird, wonderful movies that we've made. Not everything's a hit, not everything's perfect, but we've told some very interesting stories over the years.
Can I ask you, because I think often the afterlife, and it sounds like you had quite an intense lockdown, but in that afterlife, what would be those movies that stand out for you, and perhaps the moments from those lives that you because I think that's the beautiful thing about writing, is that in a sense you do excavate the lives of people who would otherwise vanish.
And the films too, there is a kind of, we are at an interesting point being back in the 20s as such, and hitting a lot of centenary milestones at the moment where, we're kind of, 4 years off the advent of the 100-year anniversary of the advent of sound in cinema, 1927. So you're now dealing with 100 years of history, and we're at that point where some of those earlier films have already been forgotten for a long time. But someone like Errol Flynn, I sort of just assumed everyone would kind of know who he was or have heard of him, even if they hadn't watched the movies. But I think we're now, there's generations beneath me at least, who don't even know who he is at all, have never heard of him. So I think it was kind of looking at some of those issues around cultural forgetfulness and what we do with older films. Like, are they treated in the same way as classics of literature, or those less interesting films, how are they revived? Because you can't go to a library and pick them out. You've got to find ways to screen them. And are they online? Are they digitally accessible? Those questions were sort of in the back of my mind. And that unloved failure of a costume that didn't sell with Russell Crowe represented that perfectly to me, that there was this steep depreciation in the value of those earlier films.
Look, it's a tremendous work, I think, and from that perspective, and also just because, as I say, not being somebody who is a film buff, who watches a lot of television or knows a lot, I found it an engrossing read, and also I actually just felt as though I learned a lot, and might perhaps have, I might even do a few little sort of searches to see if I can find, to some of the films and the moments. But I guess also, I mean, because, Castmates is your second novel, or second book, with Rapids your first, and so I am curious, does it get easier, does the writing get easier, did you learn from the first? What was it like going into your second book, because you pitched for it, so you obviously wanted to do it?
Yes, I definitely did. I've sort of been thinking about this lately. I've got the Saul Bellow line in my head that's like, the first book, he saw his first book as the master's and the second book as the PhD. And then I was sort of talking to a friend yesterday, and she had this great line. I can't remember who said it, but that the third book turns the star system into a constellation that you need, get the through line thread, which is really also very lovely. But I think there is a sense of graduating a little bit. I really didn't know what I was doing with that first book. I was learning on the go. I wrote it very quickly. It was on a very personal topic, and I didn't want to sit with the topic for very long. And then
it was a beautiful intensity of language. I only managed to get a little bit of a look at it. I will actually order it, but there's a beautiful intensity of language. And what struck me is that even though they're both nonfiction, is that you actually very much, had to do different things and write differently in each of those books, which I think you did, beautifully. But I still imagine that there was a lot that you took away from that first experience in in producing cast notes.
Yeah, it's a bit more like it is more research heavy. And I think my research skills had built quite considerably, and there were understandings of how to approach gaps and how to better, more comprehensively analyze a text that I definitely felt more in command of in Castmates than the Rapids.
Because that was something that struck me, because that is where the skill in writing comes, doesn't it? Is, you know, it's quite straightforward when you've got a lot of information. It's quite straightforward to tell it, isn't it? You know, like you've got all of the facts that will do the work for you, and you know your job is really just to get it out there, arrange it. But in the case of case notes, because you were dealing with so many forgotten or hidden or erased or, you know, sort of histories and things like that, I admired the craft and the technique in ensuring that there was still that richness and fullness to the story where you were sort of, I guess, working hard as a writer to include the gaps because they're actually important, but in such a way that the reader, enjoys a book.
No, definitely. And I think, you know, like partly it was extending my skills in biography as well. And biography being such a great way to hang a story is to tell someone's life story. And really that came from the Rapids as well, was not only telling my own story, but there were a couple of subjects in there where I tried to write the life stories as well. So it was like building on those skills in biography as well, I think.
Yeah, because I think so often people don't appreciate the writing and the skill that goes into it, because it feels like it's a very, you know, sort of natural and in easy thing to do, but it really isn't. And as I say, I was really struck in those opening chapters of Rapids as well, and a much more fragmentary kind of structure as well. So yeah, like total hats off, because fantastic. But the thing that I would also love to talk to you about is because you do actually wear many hats. you have also been the director and CEO of the Emerging Writers Festival, launched Digital Writers Festival, and, you know, sort of founding host of ReReaders podcast, teaching. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit, you know, perhaps about how all of that fits in, but also because I imagine that there's an element of, you know, sort of vision that goes into those roles as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, partly it's just a day job. and I kind of just developed a skill set in terms of working in the not-for-profit sector. You know, my first job was with what was then the New South Wales Writers Centre, now Writing New South Wales, working in sort of their programs departments. So trying to find, I suppose, public expressions of writing. And it's hard, you know, it's hard. Writing doesn't necessarily lend itself to public programming in the same way that obviously music, you go and perform the music, and movies, you screen the movie. Writing is a solitary act in terms of its consumption, reading, but how do you present it publicly? That just isn't the same old writers' festival panel performance kind of structure. So I think early on in my career, it was very much trying to think how to break that stuff out of the box. And Emerging Writers Festival presented itself as an option to really, you know, play around, whether it was launching the Digital Writers Festival, or we would do crazy things. We would, you know, like put a panel on in the dark so you didn't know who the writers were. So it was an anonymous panel and they could speak freely. And, you know, we toured some writers across Indonesia and made amazing kind of cultural connections between Bali and Melbourne. And, you know, there was just a bit of a sandbox kind of energy to it, that it was just playing around. And certainly, you know, the digital stuff was super helpful, that organization had that infrastructure and sort of knew how to move everything online when COVID hit. And you know, I saw a lot of kind of writing organizations play catch up in that sense. But it was a fun part of my career. I don't have a huge stomach for writers' festivals anymore after that. They are a necessary part of the industry.
Yeah, because I think that's the other thing that I'm always really interested in is, I guess, filling that gap or, you know, sort of those important stepping stones between, you know, sort of being somebody who has, you know, manuscript or a love of writing and, you know, sort of the as you say, that solitary act of consumption, the book that we pick up off the shelves, because as you say, writers will often struggle in ways that perhaps, I mean, musicians struggle, but differently. So just, I think, in terms of, and perhaps because you've been so deeply involved in these kinds of, activities, you know, sort of perhaps not being aware of how much you've contributed to that, that infrastructure and...
No, totally. I get what you're saying as well. Like, I think probably if you think about it, as well, there's a huge social function to writers' festivals, and there is a community building function to them too that is important, and particularly for the sort of more on the margins, not for profit, you know, that have strong kind of mission statements that are for writers, not just as readers' festivals, which some of the bigger state-based festivals are, that they create space and connections for writers themselves. And certainly I benefited from that in my 20s and into my early 30s, having that kind of community where otherwise there may not have been one.
Yeah, and I think just in terms of, you know, sort of creating a perception or of the fact that actually there are a whole heap of steps, you know, sort of between developing your craft and, you know, sort of being an author. And I think without those kinds of institutions like the Emerging Writers Festivals and, you know, sort of the digital writing festivals and you know, that work of, say, for example, rereading where people are talking writing to writers, then I think it can be very difficult. And so I certainly would want to, you know, sort of thank you for doing that kind of work, because I can actually remember first hearing about an emerging writers festival and thinking, just what is it, you know, what is it, what might be an emerging writer?
Yeah,
you know, where are they coming out of?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the point, is not to get stuck in those categories either. Or like, don't be just going to the festivals. Make sure you're doing your research and your writing too. But they've got a really important nurturing function to them.
Yeah, and so could I just get you perhaps to finish up, just to talk a little bit about being a writer today, you know, what that looks like, and I guess just any tips or advice.
Yeah, sure. I'm now doing my PhD, having said that the last book felt like a PhD. I'm now doing a proper one. So I'm back to the academy to, beg for money, a scholarship and, a little paying wage to work on the next thing. And I think it is that sort of like, you know, if you want to do this, it's finding those little life rafts out in the ocean and jumping on them when you see them and holding on for dear life. And whatever gets you to the next kind of project, you know, go for that. But don't think too much about the life raft itself. Think about, you know, where you want to get to. I feel supported now for book three and whatever that may be. And it's just kind of making sure that you've got the support that you need to spend the time to do something properly. And it does take a lot of time. It's like, I'm realizing it's 5 years between projects for me at the moment, and I don't intend to get any faster. In fact, I probably will try and slow it down a bit so I can get more minute. Take the time, I think, is the main thing.
Look, Sam, thank you so much. You've been so generous, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening today. That's it for From the Lighthouse for now. Please remember to like us wherever you listen to your podcasts.